Nation. I'm Matt Gentile, and this is the first episode of a special series from the Rebuildable podcast. Welcome to Grading Gar Packs. Throughout this series, we'll be grading the performance of John Paxson and Gar Foreman's 16-year reign leading the Chicago Bulls. After today's first show, we'll start grading different portions of the Gar Packs era. I'll be joined by two guests in the next three episodes. During each of those episodes, the panel will grade everything from Gar Packs' drafts and free agency moves to their trades and coaching hires. And that'll include all the good, the bad, and yes, the missed opportunities. So how are we breaking down the Gar Packs era? Well, the first period will cover the 2003-04 season to the conclusion of the 2007-08 season. The second period will cover the 2008-09 season through the 2013-14 season. And the third period will cover the 2014-15 season through the present day. When those shows are finished, I'm going to wrap up the series with a recap episode and give you the final grade based on the grading from the previous episodes. Please make sure to check out the Rebuildable Twitter handle to see who's coming on to be a part of those panels. Again, that's at rebuild_a_bull. If you've listened to my shows before, you know my policy. I don't like to reveal names of guests until the episodes have actually been recorded. I don't ever want to get your hopes up in case they can't make it on or, you know, something happens. Life can get in the way at times. Now, I want to start things off today in this first episode with an overview because I think it's important to put things in perspective to help set the stage for this entire series. And who better to have on than Jack Silverstein to talk about the history of really any team in Chicago sports. Jack is a notable Chicago sports historian. If you follow him on Twitter, you know he provides a lot of great insight and details on a wide variety of topics. But I really enjoy reading his threads about the Bulls. If you want to read a nuanced opinion and learn things about the team's history, definitely give him a follow on Twitter. He's at ReadJack. If you haven't followed him already, do it now. You won't regret it. So let's bring him in and talk about the Gar Packs era. Jack, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to give you a suggestion. I really think you need to adopt the nickname the Taylor of Twitter, because the way that you work a thread is better than anybody on the planet.
Man, I feel like somebody, not to swipe that, I feel like someone hooked me up with that. I don't know. I've entered the Shaq phase of my life where all of a sudden I'm just getting hit with all sorts of nicknames, except I'm not writing them. So I guess that's a little bit. Oh, no, you did it. You did it.
Yeah, I was about to tell you that was me.
That was you. Yeah. Okay, good deal.
The way that you craft your threads, actually, it gave me inspiration for this discussion, really, about the Gar Packs era. And looking at your take, you had a thread that you did, I think, back on April 11th about John Paxson. And you just said, I miss this guy. And you went into the details of what John Paxson meant as a player. And I think it's something that a lot of younger Bulls fans don't understand, is just how good John Paxson was as a player.
I do miss him. I mean, even if he had left the Bulls, probably even after 2012, 2013, shoot, if he had stepped down with Tibbs, if he had, like, fired Tibbs and fired himself or something, I really think things would have been a lot better in terms of how the city of Chicago still feels. And now, unfortunately, we've reached a point where old Bulls fans, and I don't mean me, I mean, like, I'd say you're an old fan by 20, 25. I mean, that's, you know, 20 in your teens is when you're at your height almost. In your 20s is like you're super experienced. 25, you're kind of like looking on the other side of it a little bit. And a 25-year-old was born in Paxson's final season as a player. So we're at a point where his whole legacy as a player has been superseded in many respects by what he's done as a GM. And, you know, you and I are going to chop this up. He had some wonderful years, great years as a GM, but now he's kind of washed over that as well, just painted right over it. And it sucks, quite frankly, because he's someone who should be, you know, getting standing ovations in restaurants, and he should be jumping on wherever with, like, Lawrence Holmes or Cap or, you know, the bigs. He should be jumping on these shows and just doing old school, cool, I was the man, I hit the shot. And instead, he's got some serious, I mean, I don't know if he views it this way, but, you know, among fans, he's got some serious reputational rehab to go through. And it hasn't even begun because he's still there.
Well, it's amazing, too, because if you think about it, when he retired after the 94 season, he was on the bench with Phil Jackson for, what, about a year and a half, and then ended up getting into the broadcasting on the radio and I think on WGN TV for a little bit there, too. And, you know, he was really good at that. He was really good at breaking down the Bulls, and that's why I think even, you know, the next generation of Bulls fans might have looked at him a lot differently had he never stepped into that role. It's like you wonder if he knew what he actually was getting into when he did that.
It's crazy. I mean, you mentioned the booth. So, yeah, I mean, John Paxson in various capacities has been a Chicago Bulls employee since 1985 when he came over as a guard from the Spurs. And you really can't make this up because of the way free agency worked at the time. John Paxson arrived to the Bulls for cash considerations.
Wow. You can't script that.
You can't script it, bro. When you think about what Stacey King's reputation was as a player and what John Paxson's reputation was as a player and how people now view them, I mean, it's totally flipped. You 25-year-old Bulls fan, they were born, again, this reference the 94 season, they were born the year that Stacey was traded to Minnesota for Luke Longley. They don't know the guy who we drafted instead of Sean Kemp. They don't know the guy who tried to, in vain always, to get Horace Grant's starting job and couldn't do it. Maybe they've read the Jordan rules, maybe not. If not, they don't know the guy who MJ was dissing left and right about his weight. It's amazing what, you know, what TV or what just like a second career can do for you. Mm-hmm. And Stacey is like Bulls royalty at this point. And listen, that's cool. That's great because he was never like a bad dude. He just wasn't a great player and he was a first round pick. And so there are certain expectations. Although listen, shout out to Stacey for being on the floor for the comeback in game 6 against Portland. But he just never became that great player. And then traded him to Minnesota for Luke Longley. And was like, wow, we traded Stacey King for Luke Longley. But gosh, lo these many years later, Stacey King is beloved in this city. And John Paxson is, I mean, again, I don't think he views it this way. I've never gotten any inclination from an interview that he does, but he's part of a Chicago sports nightmare at this point. And it's like, this is the guy who has one of the most legendary moments in sports history. A three on the road in game 6, back when it was 2-3-2 in the finals, a three while down 2. The stones to take that shot. I mean, think about it. He caught that pass with, you know, just under 6 seconds, 5.5 seconds, something like that. I mean, he was pretty wide open. He could have taken a few dribbles in and just tried to knock down a jumper to tie the game at 98. But man, no, he kicked it. He hit that three. He took it. He had it and he hit it. I cite that as the greatest finals moment in Bulls history. We're talking about a history that includes MJ's last shot and a flu game and a shrug and Steve Kerr and Scottie Pippen's steal and change hands layups and everything. And I think that's the best. So to see where he is now, I wasn't kidding. I mean, it's upsetting. It's, I mean, on the list of things that don't actually really matter, you know, obviously I should keep things in perspective, but like in that piece of me where sports is still so vital, yeah, it sucks. It really sucks.
One thing that you brought up, you're talking about the 93 finals. I mean, people even forget about 1991, how vital he was in game 5 against the Lakers when, you know, he hit some key shots to put the Lakers away.
NBC named him their player of the game. This was a night where Scottie Pippen had 32 points to lead the Bulls. Mike had, I think, 30. He had 10 or 11 assists. But Pax's jumpers, like you said, down the stretch, they were just these continue. You know, if the three-pointer against Phoenix is a singular knockout blow, well, this was death by a thousand cuts. And, oh, yeah, he was awesome.
One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on, because you have such a good, such a vast knowledge of Chicago sports, especially the Bulls, and, you know, I really wanted to dive into what the Garpax experience has been about. And really, it all starts in the year 2003 after Jerry Krause steps down due to health problems, wink, wink, and John Paxson is hired as general manager of the Chicago Bulls. Some of the other names at that time, B.J. Armstrong, and I think Jim Stack was the other name that was being tossed around a lot that spring. Yeah. But what do you think were some of those key moves that John Paxson made to sort of set the foundation? Because what he was inheriting was an absolute mess.
Yeah, it definitely was. The number of people who hung around and actually stayed after the Bulls disintegrated in the summer of 99, who actually stayed and continued to watch the team, it was grim, man. I mean, I have one of my best friends. We were friends growing up, but we were never, like, super-duper tight. But now we're you know, best of friends. And part of our bond was that we were both watching the Bulls in the early 2000s. Like, if you found someone who was watching the Bulls in the early 2000s, you latched on to that person and they to you, because it was just such a drop-off. You know, we had gone through, let's count them out. Okay, I would say that the first proper rebuild was the 99 draft with Brand and Ron Artest. And that lasted 2 years. We traded Brand to the Clippers for the draft rights to Tyson Chandler. Chandler and Eddie Curry, that's the beginning of that term in this iteration, Baby Bulls. It actually goes back further, but in terms of the way that people talk about it now, post-dynasty, that was the beginning of that. And then Tim Floyd got fired. And there are a number of different ways to define where an era starts and ends, but certainly the hiring and firing of a head coach is one of them. So Tim Floyd was finally – or no, he resigned, but he was going to be fired on Christmas Eve in 2001, and they brought in Bill Cartwright. But I would say that the first really significant piece for John Paxson was firing Bill Cartwright, who was his friend. And they played for many years together, and they were also bonded as being the two kind of non-stars of the first three-peat. So they had a bond, and – I remember feeling like when he did that, that was a significant, like, this isn't going to be about homerism, nepotism, buddy-buddy stuff. I was like, okay, all right. I mean, technically speaking, Pax's first big move was when Jay Williams got into his motorcycle. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we had to draft Kirk Heinrich. But I mean, gosh, that portends to problems to come, because we could have moved up for D Wade, and we didn't want to trade Danielle Marshall, and then we ended up trading Danielle Marshall anyways, a couple months into the season. But you know, that aside, I would say firing Cartwright and hiring Scott Skiles, and then the big trade where we sent Jalen Rose out of town for Antonio Davis, and that was another change. I'm looking at this, so those were 3 days apart. We hired. Mm-hmm. Fired Cartwright November 24th, hired Skiles November 28th, and made the Jalen for Antonio Davis. There were other guys involved, but made that trade December 1st, 2003. Now, what I'll say to frame this a little bit for listeners is, as a Bulls fan now, you look at the team and you say, okay, what is it going to take to build another champion? And one of the major problems, maybe the major problem, that the Bulls have had post-MJ and post-Scotty, is we haven't been able to sign our number one, or even at any point our number two free agent choice. I guess maybe Pau Gasol would be considered your number two choice. But that's been a huge, huge problem. And this idea that right now, well, yeah, we've got these wonderful young players, we've got a lot of pieces. We don't have, like, draft capital, but we have a lot of talented young players. But the question is, other than the head coach, are we going to be able to get a free agent? You know, it's going to be like free agent city every few years now. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's what it's looking like. 2021, you've got, I don't remember the whole list, but LeBron, Kawhi, Paul George, I think Kyrie Irving, like a bunch of those guys have lined that up.
And
Giannis, yeah. And so the question is, are we ever going to be able to capitalize on the assets that we build, the young talent, and select the right few players to keep and select the right player to trade or somehow get cap space, etc. And the reason that looking at John Paxson's early time with the Bulls is instructive in this regard is that he was able, this was before it was, quote, Gar Pax, and this is when he was running the show, he was able to take all these terrible pieces and this horrible run outside of the playoffs from 99 to 04, or at that point to 03, and he was able to turn this big mess in about a year and a half into a playoff team mm-hmm. that had a real identity, that wasn't a fluke, and crucially, that had no all-stars. And they had, when we made the playoffs in 04-05, we had Antonio Davis, who had had, he'd been a one-time all-star in 2001. We had Luol Deng, who was a rookie, who would go on to be a two-time all-star. But listen, neither of those guys were anywhere near all-star level at that point. And no. Even all-star level for Antonio Davis wasn't really even all that. So I do think about that period and think about what Pax was able to do. And I think that the way that he was able to do it, and what I feel like as a fan, what I feel like is missing now is vision. There's no real vision. There's nothing cohesive that says this is the kind of team we want. There are buzzwords, but even they violate those buzzwords. But if you think about what they built in or what Pax built for that 04-05 season, it was a pretty clear blueprint. It was, okay, we've got Tyson and Curry. We'll roll with them. They traded a flashier, more talented player in Jalen Rose for Antonio Davis, and Jerome Williams came over in that trade. He wasn't on the playoff team, but he came over. He fit that mold. But then, I mean, I don't have to tell you this, but they went after a type. And the type was hard-nosed, successful, mm-hmm. collegiate talent. And you could even say that Andres Nocioni, even though he wasn't a college player, but his experience in the Olympics and his experience coming up in that respect almost doubled as that. So, like, you had Ben Gordon, who had been a national champ. You had Chris Duhon, who had been a national champ, multiple Final Fours. You had Kirk Heinrich, who'd been the starting point guard for a team that lost the national title by 3 points. You had Noach who had won who'd won the gold in 04, and I'm missing someone. And then and Luol had been to a Final Four with Duke. So they went after that kind of a core, and that Bulls team started 0-9. And then turned it around, and they turned it around by, I mean, sort of embracing all of the sort of cliche fundamentals. They, you know, passed the ball. They supported each other. They played real hard-nosed defense. And so I think about that team a lot because there was a vision there and because there was no superstar, but they were able to win 47 games. All right, I'll shut up.
No. No, I think that 2004 offseason, though, was a massive, massive part of that blueprint that you're talking about, because really, you are right. There was a game plan in place, and sort of what you're seeing now as possibly what Pax is trying to replicate. I'm not sure if he's going to get there, but trying to add veteran leadership around a young core to try and attract star talent eventually. Now, you actually have to seal the deal, and I think there's a history that shows they haven't really been able to do that. But if you look back to that 2004 offseason, the drafting of Ben Gordon, Luol Deng, Chris Duhon, who would become a key piece off the bench for the Bulls, and a really big under-the-radar signing in Noach, and that did set him up for a pretty good run for the next three seasons.
Yeah, like you said, that 04 offseason, super big. I mean, people, I know that I'm sure you haven't forgotten about this, but people certainly forget that we very briefly had Dikembe Mutombo.
Mm-hmm.
We traded Jamal Crawford with Jerome Williams to the Knicks for Mutombo, Harrington, Frankie Williams. And then we traded less than a month later, or just around a month later, we traded Mutombo to the Rockets for Eric Pytkowski, Adrian Griffin, and Mike Wilkes. So that's from the Jamal Crawford trade, that's Harrington and Pike and Griffin, who are three of the key bench veterans. I don't remember there being a whole conversation at the time about we're going to put these young players together, this veteran team, and then we're going to have an eye on a certain free agent class. It wasn't like when we were clearing cap space in 2000 or certainly 2010. It wasn't like that. It was just like, we have to figure out how to right the ship after all these terrible years. It's my favorite, like, funny thing about the Bulls that era. Tell me if you remember this, but this always killed me. This killed me at the time. We won 30 games in 2003, the year with Jalen. It was the first 30-win season since Jordan and Pippen. And the next year for 03-04, the Bulls marketing slogan was history in the making. Mm-hmm. And instead, we only won, I think it was 23 games. And so for 04-05, the marketing slogan was through thick and thin, which I just remember at the time just being like, that is just too funny. But it was like through thick and thin. And that's the team that goes to the playoffs, is the team that marketing is even being like, yo, our bad. So it wasn't really a team that was being set up to like cash in a big way. It was just like, let's get the foundation right. And the difference, I mean, you mentioned that maybe Pax is trying to do that now, but the biggest difference and the thing that bothers me to such a great degree, and obviously I certainly am not alone in this respect among Bulls fans, is with regards to Paxson, Foreman, what is the bar? Like, I'm not rooting for anyone to get fired per se, but what do they have to fall below to lose their jobs? Because without any sense of fear that that might occur, where is the motivation to improve beyond just, I guess, a competitor's desire to do so? That's what bugs me. This team could be a lot of fun. They could be. And it's going to be an exciting season around the Bulls. We've got the All-Star game for the first time since 88. ESPN is coming out with the 10-part doc on the 98 team. I would assume it's going to be early, but either way, you're going to have the All-Star game in Chicago. I would bet that LaVine, assuming he's healthy and still a Bull, I would bet that they get LaVine in the dunk contest. I would bet that LaVine does at least one dunk in an MJ jersey. And I would bet that it's a free throw dunk, but with some like additional twist, because, you know, LaVine can go like through the legs. You're going to have like that kind of a vibe around Chicago and around this franchise, which is really exciting. But it's like, what do these guys have to do to not have jobs? Because John Paxson in 2004, he was only in his second, or, you know, and going into the 04-05 season, that was going to be his second season, because he came at the end of 03. So that's where I'm at as a Bulls fan. It's not that I don't think that, like, LaVine is good, or Laurie, or Wendell, or that, you know, Kobe White. It's not that I don't look at these guys and think, okay, yeah, this is a cool team, there's some fun talent here. And everyone who I know who knows Jim Boylan says, gosh, he really is, you know, someone who's kind of inspiring. And you can see why players want to play for him. But that aside, what do these guys have to do to be considered out of a job? Because if there isn't anything, then I don't know how I as a fan can get super excited. If they fail, it doesn't matter, because they're just going to blow it up and start over. Additionally, we didn't have in 04-05, we didn't quite have this whole pattern. We didn't have as much of the pattern of what the Bulls organization does once a star player or coach or both reach a peak of stardom achievement and popularity, and the way that they have kind of systematically turned portions of the press against portions of the fan base, I mean, turned the fan base through the press against players and coaches, just like, I want to break this cycle. I want to break this cycle more than I wanted to break, you know, 99 to 04. It's bugging me, dude. I'm not gonna lie.
I'm glad that I'm you know, I feel like your therapist right now. I'm your bull shrink.
A little bit. That's why I can't do too many of these shows. I gotta really space them out.
No, and I mean, look, what you're saying though makes a lot of sense, and I think that's the growing frustration for Bulls fans. It's one of the reasons why I've been doing really this podcast, is to kind of give some people hope, you know, by sort of passing it on to podcasters and different broadcasters to offer their ways of getting out of a mess like this, because I think it's been too long to watch them try and get it right. You know, 16 years, you don't see executives in the league around that long that haven't won a ring.
No, it's crazy. Have you had Fred on yet?
Oh, I've had C Red Fred on, of course. Second episode we had him on.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about hope, Fred is really the voice. Fred's the voice of hope.
Yeah, Fred always cites the beginning of John Paxson's tenure whenever he's talking about that hope, right? Because I think, you know, I was around 13 or 14 when Pax got the job. And I could tell you, like, when you're that age, you know, you kind of look at things through a different lens. And I know I was super optimistic about the Bulls in that time. You know, like, I actually thought that this was a team that could slowly build into a contender. And I know probably in the summer of 2006 when they signed Ben Wallace, I was like, all right, let's go. Let's finish it off. Let's go after another guy. Let's get it done. And, you know, I ended up being sorely disappointed.
I'll tell you, that 04-05 team, that is, if I had to just look at Bulls teams that didn't win a championship and rank my favorite seasons, 94 is clear-cut first. Mm. But 05 is clear-cut second. And my buddy Ben, the one I was telling you about, Ben and I remember at some point late in that 0-9 start, maybe we were 0-7, 0-8, somewhere in there, maybe 0-9. And we were just like, this is the best Bulls team we've seen in the past 6 years. Like, this, something is happening here. We were like, we're 0-9, but opening night, we lost a double overtime game to the Nets. And then I just, like, Duhon and Luol were starting to cook a little bit. Duhon was still coming off the bench. And it just felt like there was something there. I mean, you can sometimes feel when a team is better than their record, and that team was. And it was just this mixture of grit and skill and heart. And really, the other key piece was, like I said, it was that experience. And you could feel like there's a vision here, there's a blueprint here, you can see sort of the moves that Pax is making. And that's what we've lost in large respects. It's like, what are the moves? Like, we finally have achieved the younger and more athletic, but I still just don't understand what has to happen for these guys to lose their job security. And it's really made me, it's kind of made me broken. And the Bulls outsiders, Matt Peck, he's a little bit of a downer. John is just funny. Dave and I go back a little bit. Me, Dave, Chris, the Ball Sports guys. Mm-hmm. They're up. Nobody's up like Fred. Fred's in the clouds when it comes to enthusiasm and hope. His whole 777 thing is hilarious. But like, you've got, look at this. I mean, you've got all these Bulls fans, and you've got all these different reactions to how do I interact with a team. And we saw the same thing with the Cubs over many, many years. It was like, there's some people who just, their attitude with the Cubs is, hey, it's cool, I'm having a fun time at Wrigley. There's other people who are like, we have to bulldoze Wrigley. The team will never win if they have this golden ticket. And there were other people who were in the sense the late great John from Cubs Den, John Aguayo, who was a minor league head. And so he was always watching the people coming up. My friend Jimmy, sort of the same way. But what it tells me when you're at that point is, as a fan, you're kind of like looking for the way that you can make this situation palatable. Do I apply excessive hope and positivity? Do I say, okay, I'm just going to take this realism tact and look at like the foundation that's growing at the root, which is easier in baseball, obviously, because of the farm leagues. Do I take a fully negative, like, I'm going to boycott? I boycotted the Cubs for a little bit. Not boycott, but it was like I like went through detox, basically, like in 2012. But what that is, it's just a legion of damaged, desperate, hurting sports fans who are trying to find the least amount of pain. They're trying to somehow create an experience for themselves that they can almost like apply as a balm over this terrible wound. And that's what you're seeing right now with the Bulls. So when you talk about like, where's the rebuild and how's it going to work? We look at, you know, what Pax did in what Pax did from 03 to 05, and then from 05 to 07, getting a good team into position to potentially be a great team or a potential. They weren't quite a championship contender, but they were an Eastern Conference contender, 49 wins. And mm-hmm. right till the end, it looked like we were going to be a 50-win team, the end of that 07 season. And mm-hmm. and then what Gar and what Paxton did 09, 10, 11, although obviously a lot of that had to do with luck. I mean, that's why I look at that 405 team, because there really was no luck involved there. It wasn't like the Derrick Rose 1.3%. It wasn't like something like where now LeBron just decides, I want to go to X team and I have my own reasons and I'm going to do this. And it's sort of independent of what a team has put together, this cap space, you know, cap space as a bare minimum. But like, other than that, he's in a position to just say, this is what I want to do with my career. Those things, from a managerial perspective, those things are luck. And there was no luck with the 04-05 rebuild. Like you said, they fired a coach. They hired the right coach. They got rid of bad contracts. Eddie Robinson. Did Pippen retire? I feel like
Pippen. Yeah, Pippen retired in the summer of 2004.
He retired, but I feel like that was another wink, wink, we're going to kind of send you on your way kind of a deal.
Oh, yeah, that was a golden parachute.
Yeah, exactly. So he retired, but they made the good trade, basically like the Jalen Rose for Antonio Davis trade, even though, as we said, there are other people there. They make the good trade with Jamal Crawford. They make a good trade with Dikembe Mutombo. They make a good deal to acquire Luol, and then that foundation of those four picks, and even reacting, listen, I don't know to the degree that people knew what Dwayne Wade was going to become. He certainly was a better player coming out of college than Kirk Heinrich, but even setting aside the error of not going after Wade with the D. Marshall move, getting Kirk Heinrich was a nice move. I mean, he was, I think, the all-rookie team that year. The first team was LeBron, Wade, Melo, Bosch, and Kirk. So there wasn't any luck involved with that 04-05 team. They just built a strong group from 1 to 12. Gennaro Pargo.
Yeah.
Everybody knew how everybody was going to contribute. And then when they had the, when that terrible heart condition cropped up for Curry, and they tried to make him that deal where they were going to pay him, I'm forgetting the numbers now, but was it $50 million over 50 years? Was it like $1 million a year annuity, basically? And he didn't want that. So then they swing that trade with the Knicks, mm-hmm. that ends up netting, well, nearly LaMarcus Aldridge had we not traded him for Tyrus and the Joakim Noah pick.
Yes.
There were, again, like, there wasn't a lot of luck. And what the position that we're in now as Bulls fans is we need some level of luck. I mean, they still think that they're going to sign free agents in 2021. And my question is, what will change? What will change between now and then that's going to rewrite the notion around the league that is, however you feel about it, whether it's earned or not, this notion that the Bulls don't take care of their stars and this notion that the Bulls are, you know, a second or third tier franchise. What's going to change in 2021?
Well, yeah, let me ask you this question. I kind of wonder when the shift happened, and I think I want to get your perspective on that. When do you think the tide turned for the perception of John Paxson? Perception as an executive, when did that change?
I would say that like the underpinnings were the way that everything went down with Derek between 13, but specifically 13 and 14, but really 2013. I would say that was part of the start, because that some people obviously came out of that 2013 experience and were like, Derek screwed the team. He was ready. He was cleared. He didn't play. So there were some people who certainly took a negative rose tact. But I think that there were other fans who looked at who started to look at Paxson and Foreman and just said, man, how is it that they weren't able to manage Derek's health and his body in 2012 in the shortened, you know, in that condensed schedule during the lockout or after the lockout? You know, he only played 39 games of that year, and he had a number of injuries that went like across his body. Mm-hmm. He had the groin, I think a back maybe, and it just kept, you know, one exacerbated another, and that's what led to the knee injury. And I feel like that injury and the fallout from that and the sort of run-up probably up to 2014, I would say that was like the negative start. That was the start of the tide turning. And I don't know if that's fair or not, but it was this feeling that, well, you're in charge and we're blowing it. Like, it's right here for us and you're blowing it. And like, I don't, sort of this feeling of like, I don't care that our MVP is injured. Like, what's the plan? And I think when there was a sense that they didn't know what the plan was. So like when we traded Luol, or when we couldn't sign Carmelo Anthony. Now, I'm a big Carmelo Anthony fan. I know a lot of people don't like him, don't like his game. But the fact remains was that he was their number one free agent target. So when you miss out on your top free agent targets in 2000, you miss out on your top free agent targets in 2010, then you come back around, you miss out on your top free agent targets in 2014. I think that was another hit. Mm-hmm. I think then the way that the team fell apart in 2015 – against the Cavs and that horrible game six, and then firing Tibbs, and then the feeling of history repeating itself. You were going back to the Iowa State well. And so now you were starting to talk about Foreman and by extension Paxson in these like glacial generational terms, because Gar Foreman is a Tim Floyd hire.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the last of the Tim Floyd hire. But it's like, well, how is there a Tim Floyd hire still anywhere in power, let alone, I mean, on this team at all, let alone still at the position that he holds? And so I think that when that failed in 2014, and then when the team sort of fell apart in 15, and then when you fired Tibbs and they went back to Hoiberg, there was a feeling of like, oh god, this feels like Tim Floyd all over again. just because on the surface, you know, sometimes that's all people have. Sometimes fans, you know, not everyone's going to follow a team the same way. And not everyone's going to be like digging deep in the details. And not everybody watches college sports. I don't watch college sports. You know, I watch a little bit like on a Saturday night here or there, but like kind of as a rule, I don't really watch college sports anymore. D1 men's basketball and then football. So not everybody gets the full story. So I think then getting the Fred Hoiberg and feeling like, oh, it's an Iowa State coach, no NBA experience. And then also the fact that he was here in those terrible years as a point guard for us, I think that was a huge piece. And then, let's see, 16, and then trading Derek and like losing Noah, watching that Tibbs team completely fall apart, and then the younger and more athletic. That's one of those – that's like the read my lips, no new taxes – of recent Bulls history. There are just some statements that immediately are so catchy that then if you violate them, it's impossible for people to let go of that. And just like George H.W. Bush, and people really couldn't let go of that when he turned around and, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was the same kind of a thing. How are you going to say, oh, we're going younger and more athletic, and then you're going to add Rondo and Wade? I mean, everybody saw through that. And that's when I think it was like, oh, man, there's no plan here.
I feel like there was this myth, too, that started to bust in, that Gar Forman was making all these terrible decisions in his reign after 2009. That a lot of what was going on at the end of the Bulls' reign with Derrick Rose, that it was a Gar Forman issue. I think my problem with that is, well, you know, John's still executive vice president of basketball operations. I mean, he's still the buck's got to stop at him. So I didn't understand why, you know, some Bulls fans were willing to sort of jump onto that narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue with the Bulls has been that it's been kind of this clunky two-headed monster, and in other ways it's been a four-headed monster when you consider Jerry and then Michael Reinsdorf. And it's been this sense of like, well, who's in charge? And maybe people turned against Gar because of a feeling of loyalty toward Pax. Maybe they turned against Gar because of a feeling that something changed and so it must be Gar's doing. That he'd been executive of the year. Maybe it was that. Once it became Gar Pax as a name, then I think Paxson was in a lot of trouble. You really don't want your name. You never want to lose control of your name. That was one of Obama's biggest mistakes. He should never have let the ACA be called Obamacare. That was really, really dumb. Because whenever you let your name become synonymous with your job, then if something goes wrong with your job, now something has gone wrong with your name. Now it's you. And I think once they became Gar Pax, that was probably a big problem for Paxson. And I mean, like, it didn't seem that way at first. I'm reminding myself this Gar Pax was around in like 09 and 10. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a problem yet. It just still felt like, okay, that's just like a fun little name. But it reached a point, obviously. You say, when did the tide turn? I mean, I think that when was the tide completely turned, would you say? I would say it was the three alphas. Once they hit that, I know Jerry Seinfeld has a bit. I remember Jerry had a bit about it's like when you're walking with somebody and they're leading and they make like one left turn too many and then they stop and then look over their shoulder, that's when you know you're in a lot of trouble. And it's like, oh, these people, I've been following you. And that was when it was like, oh no, I don't know what you guys are doing. Now, in a vacuum, let's say the Bulls had hired Pax down the stretch of the 17 season, okay? And then you look at all the moves that he's made since then, if it was just Paxson, I think people would be pretty excited. I mean, I think that people would be like, oh, look what he inherited in 2017 and the Butler trade, that turned out well. And they've drafted pretty well. They've got some versatile pieces. We'll still see what Markkanen can become. But I think that if John Paxson had come in 17, or if General Manager X had arrived in 2017 and done all the moves that Paxson and Foreman have done since then, exactly the same across the board, don't change a thing, I think people would be pretty enthusiastic, pretty high on these guys. You might even hear a little Rick Hahn vibe.
Mm.
But that's the problem with this just endless longevity, is that doesn't reset. You can rebuild a roster. You can say you're hitting the reset button on a roster, but that doesn't mean you're hitting a reset button on fans' emotions, on their experience. And that's what we've got right now. We need somehow to have a reset button on these guys. And I don't know how it's possible short of them being fired. And if that's not something that's going to happen, then I don't really know what the answer is.
So Jack, did you watch Charlie Brown?
Oh man, I wrote Charles Schulz a letter in third grade, and pages like 2 and 3 of, like, from 2 to 3 of the letter were these new paragraph break. These are all of the characters I can name by heart.
So I think you're going to appreciate this reference then. I really think that Gar Packs are basically like Charlie Brown going to kick the football that Lucy's put out. Because I think...
Wait. Gar Packs is Charlie Brown in this case?
Yes, going to kick the football.
Who's Lucy?
Lucy's just the rest of the league pulling the football away. I really think that...
That's really generous of you, bro. That is really generous. We are Charlie Brown, and Gar Packs is Lucy.
Well, and this is what I was going to say, though, because I think they... We talked a little bit about the missteps already, but, you know, some of the missed moves, you brought up Wade on draft night 2003. I think we can even talk about KG to the Bulls rumors that lingered in 2006 and into the 2007 draft. You had the Kobe Bryant report in the summer of 2004, maybe would have been a bit of a stretch, but going into the summer 2007 into the 2008 season.
Kobe said he was already looking
at for homes
and schools.
Yes. And you even think about, like, Pau Gasol was on the trade block in the middle of the 2008 season. 2010, LeBron, Wade, Bosh. You know, that fall there was trade rumors about Carmelo Anthony. In 2014, like you mentioned, Carmelo Anthony was the Bulls' top target. You know, there was discussions about trades for Kevin Love. And I think that's the story of Gar Packs. It's that last move that has to be made. And like you said, this is, if you look at it in a vacuum, the moves that have been made since 2017 look good on paper, but we know how this is going to play out. I think that's how I feel right now as a Bulls fan. Like, I know how this is going to play out. At least that's the feeling I get.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I mean, I do think, I think you're bringing quite a bit of admirable empathy to this. And I think from that perspective, yeah, they are Charlie Brown, and the league or league trends or whatever destiny is Lucy. Yeah, mm-hmm. maybe somewhere in their Gar Packs brains, they really do think that championships are just around the corner. They're not.
If you're looking at this current roster and situation right now, I get the vibe, you know, you don't believe this is a championship contender, but where do you think the ceiling is for the current crop they have now, the core that includes Lauri Markkanen, Zach LaVine, Wendell Carter Jr., and Kobe White?
Yeah, I like this team. I came around a lot last year on Zach,
mm-hmm.
and Wendell is cool. Kobe White, for whatever this is worth, Kobe White is the first North Carolina Tar Heel on the roster since Jordan. So maybe that'll do something. That's a ridiculous thing to say. Like, I like a lot of these guys. I do. And, you know, I like what I've seen of Gafford. I didn't know a lot about him. But, man, I mean, even Dunn, as much as he's not that dude, I don't know, he's fiery. Like, in another world or on another there's something there. You know, I don't love him as our like starting point guard, and I'm glad, you know, I'll be happy when that's officially over, if it's not over already. I mean, in a way it's over already, but like, even Dunn, I kind of dig. Even Porter, I warmed up to. But the question still is, do they know what they are doing? Do they know, like, how to capitalize on this? Have they created something that can make a run at a playoff seed? I mean, are we even a playoff team right now? Maybe not. Certainly, you know, I mean, one thing that's definitely happened is that one of the ways that you used to be able to contend if you were a team without a star is that you could embrace physical basketball. You could not even bully ball, but you could just like grind your way to wins by being more physical, by bending and pushing the rules a little bit here and there. And that's out the window. You can't do that now. I mean, that would have been a way to try to edge Golden State at certain points, and you just can't do it. So I'm not real optimistic just because of the patterns that we've seen. Like, I'd love to be more naive, I guess. You know, I kind of wish that I was 15. Like, if I was 15 right now, what year is it, 2019? So that would have meant I was born in 2004. So if I was 15, then as far as I know, Jordan and Pippen never existed. Phil Jackson never existed. And I had a good little run with Derek, and now we got some young players, and let's be excited and go do it. I almost wish I was a 15-year-old Bulls fan in that respect, as much as it's like people who are my age who basked in and lived through the dynasty years, we look at these younger Bulls fans and it's like, man, I'm sorry you weren't here. I'm sorry you missed it. I'm sorry you don't know John. I'm sorry you don't know Pax. I'm sorry you only know John Paxson, executive.
It's crazy you're saying that, though, that, you know, if you're 15 right now, because I was 16 years old. I was driving a car for the first time when the Bulls were in their first playoff series since Michael Jordan in that 04-05 season.
I was at that game, game one.
Oh, yeah. It was the most fun I ever had watching basketball in my adolescence because, you know, I was young during the dynasty. I mean, I remember it, but I was young during it. And, you know, that first batch was a lot of fun. So it's kind of weird. It's coming full circle. Not in a good way, but it's coming full circle almost.
Yeah. And so I guess that's my problem is, like, could I be real optimistic? And could I project, like, maybe Markkanen takes a big jump. Maybe Levine takes a big jump. Maybe Wendell Carter becomes like a 15-9-8 guy. Maybe Kobe White turns into one of the best young guards in the league. But am I confident that at that point, John Paxson and Gar Foreman are going to know what to do with that? Are they going to know how to harvest this talent and bring it to the next stage? Why would I think that they would? Well, I mean, that's part of, like, that's one of the curses of living. That's a blessing and a curse, I guess, is perspective. Why would I look at what they've done and say, yeah, this is the duo to lead and to be able to go from a team that is terrible to a team that is fighting for the eight to a team, you know, Fred says what, 3 straight 7 picks, 17, 18, 19, 7th seed in 2020 and 7th championship in 2021. Listen, I'm a guy who made a cottage industry out of a concept called the prophecy, which I completely invented last year to say that the Bears were following the 2006 Bears because they played all the same games on the schedule and then had won and lost the exact same games, with the exception of the Giants game. So, like, you know what? I love that. And Fred's awesome and, like, bully for him. But, like, that's just, to me, I hope he's right. Like, I hope that he's driving the big red bus to Grant Park. I'm like, I hope he is. I hope he is. And I hope we all are. But right now, I'm just not feeling that. I'm just not there.
I think there's a lot of Bulls fans, you know, me included. I'm sort of in that skeptic group because we've been through this song and dance already. And I actually want to ask, I'm going to ask you one last question. Had Derrick Rose not gotten hurt, A, do you think they would have won a title? And B, how much would that have changed things, you think, for the Garpax regime?
All right. A couple thoughts here. Number one, I think that if Derrick hadn't gotten hurt, he had a chance to have one of those, I've just been hanging around and I'm going to break through at the right time championships, like Peyton Manning or Dirk Nowitzki. And I guess Dirk is a better example. Let's keep it in the same sport. I think that Derrick would have been able to get one of those. I think that he had the scoring ability. I think that he had the gamesmanship, the leadership, the tenacity. I think that he had that it factor that would define him. Not everyone who doesn't win a ring is of a lower quality in terms of their ability to take a game to a next level. I think that he had that. I remember Chris Kaysen told me that Derek gave him the vibe, or maybe Derek had told him this directly, but I remember Chris told me that Derek, he was like, Derek thinks that he was like that you, me, him, and two guys from the Y can go out and win a championship. And I always thought that was really special. Now, I think a really interesting piece, and I don't know, Bulls fans probably won't want to hear this, but I think a really interesting piece of the impact that Derek's injury had from a broader perspective is that I think it's the reason that people kill LeBron for being in, quote, a weak East. And this is going to suck to hear, but I think that Derek was going to be LeBron's Patrick Ewing. The difference being that there could have been that year. There could have been that one year where maybe like 2015. Maybe 2015, if Derek is healthy the entire time and maybe Jimmy develops not as a star, but still develops kind of alongside Derek, but they have that hierarchy down because he's not developing in the vacuum, but he's developing with Derek at that MVP level. And Derek, a healthy Derek Rose, is starting the All-Star game every year. He's finishing in the top five of the MVP voting almost every year. He is first or second team All-NBA every year. And I think that maybe 2015, if you think about how close we came against against the Cavs, I mean, up 2-1 and nearly up 3-1. God, we were right there. You know, that maybe would have been the punch through year. And that might have been the chip. I do think that there was a problem, which was that when LeBron wanted to, he could defend Derek better than anybody. And that's what we saw in the Eastern Conference Finals. Was like, and that was what made that Mavericks series such a shock, was because of how good LeBron was against the Bulls. He was so good against us that you just couldn't believe what he was doing. I would never have guessed what we were about to see in the finals. But I think that LeBron, to a degree, had Derek, I don't want to say he had his number, but he was kind of his kryptonite just because of his size and speed and power, but the way that he could totally, totally ruin Derek's rhythm and his vision at the top of the key. He essentially was doing to Derek what Scottie was doing to Mark Jackson in 98. And that was part of why the Bulls went away from having a point guard, was this idea that, like, we don't want to have that one person who, if you stop this person, the offense doesn't work. And Derek was that person. So I think that that was another part of the frustration around PAX. And it hadn't started to turn, but maybe, like, because we were still winning. So we went 50-16 in 2012. But the fact that it was like, okay, we just had this MVP year, we just had these 62 wins, got to the East Finals, we win game one, sort of all falls apart after that, literally falls apart game five. God, you want to talk about a horror show, go back and watch the end of game five. But then it's like, okay, we know what the weak link is. No offense to him. And like, I love a scrappy role player and cool, but like, we know Keith Bogans is the guy who isn't the guy. And we know that Derek needs a big scorer to take some pressure off of him. Mental pressure, but also like literal defensive pressure. I mean, we need someone who LeBron has to respect at you know, out on the perimeter. And Wade, frankly, because he was still at close to his peak at that point. And he just started to decline. But the fact that they couldn't figure out how to get anyone other than Rip Hamilton was, again, it was like, we're not there yet. Like, we're not ready. You can't quite say that the tide had turned, but the seeds were starting to be planted. And that's what happened, really, was that the seeds were planted over a series of years, but they were – you weren't seeing them. I'm probably losing my metaphor because I don't really do any gardening, but but it was starting to grow. You just weren't seeing it.
You know what's really unfortunate is that you never got to see – Derek at his peak while Jimmy Butler was ascending to the player that, you know, he ended up becoming.
Yeah, exactly. Jimmy would have been, if Derek, I mean, so here's the answer to your question. If Derek had stayed healthy and maintained a continuity of play from the end of 2012, first of all, if Derek stays healthy in 2012, we go back and we play Miami again. And I think we would lose because the problems that we had in 2011 would have still been there in 2012, even though we did so well against them in the regular season. I think we still would have ended up coming up short. But that was still no guarantee. Miami, as far as everyone was concerned, was the team that screwed up against the Mavericks. And we were a team that, once again, had the best record in the NBA. So people would have been super duper hyped for that. And gosh, look how well we did against them in 2013. Again, we won a game one. And that was with nobody. That was, I mean, by the middle of that Miami series, everybody was hurt. And yet we played them tough. And we played them tough in 2015. So I do have to believe that a healthy Derrick Rose with Jimmy, like you said, growing next to him, but still with Derrick holding that top spot in the hierarchy. It's one of the very most important pieces of winning an NBA championship and sustaining a run is everyone needs to understand what the hierarchy is. That's what kind of screwed Golden State up. You had this situation where the guy who was their best player was not deemed their most important or most beloved player. And the Warriors never really treated Kevin Durant as if he was a, quote, real warrior. That was the failing of that hierarchy. The failing with the Bulls was that Jimmy developed in Derek's vacuum. But if that hadn't been the case, Jimmy was the perfect complement to Derek. God, think about a big guard who can handle the ball, who can shoot from outside, who can create his own shot, a good rebounder, who can defend three positions, and who you have to respect off the ball.
Yeah, you mentioned the hierarchy there, and if you go to 2015, part of the reason why things fell apart in that series against the Cavs was the fact that there was a little bit of a breakdown between a healthy Derek and Jimmy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You definitely had the split. And you can't have that for a basketball team. So your first question was, would the Bulls have won a championship if Derek had stayed healthy? Yeah, I'm going to say that we would have. I can't pinpoint the year. I'll say 2015. Derek would have given that a healthy Bulls team with Derek healthy the whole time. And listen, if Derek's healthy the whole time, we don't trade Dang. I'd have to look to see exactly how the numbers in terms of cap would work out. But Derek, Jimmy, Luol, Powell, and Noah going against the 2015 Warriors, a team that was down 2-1 to a Cavs team that was starting Dellavedova. Man, yeah, I'll take those odds. Absolutely. I'll take those odds. So that might have been our breakthrough year. I don't mean breakthrough like whatever, DiCaprio and Gilbert Grape breakthrough performance. I mean like the year where you've been like banging against a wall and you break through the wall. So Dirk in 2011, where it's just you hang around and you maintain a level of excellence and discipline and you break through because something happens. Someone gets hurt. Someone makes a mistake. Someone gets fired, etc. I think maybe that would have been the year that of any year that I look at, that seems like the one that makes the most sense. And would I look at Garpacked differently if that happened? Yes, of course, they would have won a championship. Listen, you win a chip, it changes everything. So yeah, Garpacked, if we had broken through, shit. I mean, if Derek had stayed healthy, then yeah, it would be a different story. Now, they always like to say, look, what are you going to do? Like, your MVP goes down, it sets the franchise back. But it's like, dog, the only reason you're even in this position was because you lucked into it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're kind of lucking out of it. There's karma there. Not, like, emotional-driven or attitude or even action-driven karma, but just sort of, like, balance of the universe karma. Like, you didn't deserve to have Derek, and you didn't deserve to lose him. Those cancel each other out. So then it's, if you look at it that way, it's like, all right, what else have you done? So I was in a good mood too. There was a point in this call where I peaked. And I think if we'd hung up, I'd have been like, that was a lot of fun. And now I'm just bummed again, just like at the beginning. Now I've come full circle. So thank you, Matt. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And actually, though, I mean, I think that perfectly wraps up the way that the Garpacked regime has been, is that it's been it's an emotional roller coaster. So, Jack, I really appreciate you, you know, taking the time to talk about this, to dive into the history of John Paxson and Gar Forman. I could listen to you all day talk about the Bulls. So, again, thanks for coming on and really enjoyed it. Hope to talk to you more this season.
Yeah, no, definitely. This is a really cool show. I'm glad you're doing this. I love the idea. So thank you for having me on. Thank you for letting me be a part of it. And just like, I want to be clear, I've been an optimistic sports fan. And in some ways, I'm always, and I remain an optimistic sports fan. It doesn't make a difference. The team has to change.
Mm-hmm.
Something fundamental about the organization has to go. And it sucks because the 90s Bulls have become the 85 Bears of Bullsdom, or like the Wrigley Field of Bullsdom, where it feels like there's something so magical and special that happened, and now they're just riding on it. Just like, I want everyone to feel what we felt in the 90s. I want fans to feel that. That's what's beautiful. That's why I rooted for Cleveland to win a title in 2016. You want to see that. You want to see these long-suffering fans get that. What's it going to take? What do Gar and Pax have to do for this to – like, job security has got to have a limit. I'm not rooting for anybody to not eat or be homeless. They could still even work in basketball. I want to know, like, what's it take? I go to work every day and I have to perform. You have to perform. What does it take? What's it going to take? What's it going to take, fellas? Come on, Jerry. What's it going to take? Tell us what the bar is. Tell us what to expect. Tell us what this is that we're looking at. What's the vision? Tell us and stick to it. And then, yeah, then I'll be able to be excited about this young team and this All-Star game that we're about to be hosting for no good reason.
That is like the cherry on top of the sundae right there, Jack. It's perfect. Again, thank you for coming on and sharing your thoughts about the Chicago Bulls.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, man. I'm going to go do dishes and watch replays of 97 Vine.
That's a good way to cheer yourself up.
All right. Peace. Can we go back? This is the moment. Tonight is the night. We'll fight till it's over. So we brought our hands up like the ceiling can hold us. Like the ceiling can hold us.
Thank you for listening to the Rebuildable Podcast. Be sure to check out more episodes on Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Rebuildable.com.